This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. UW-Milwaukee is celebrating the 40th anniversary of the American Geographical Society Library coming to the school. This collection, made up of more than 1.3 million items, including maps, atlases, and books, is the second largest map collection in the country. Materials include a map showing what a European mapmaker thought the world looked like in 1452, along with charts signed and used by aviator Charles Lindbergh. Marcy Bidney is the Assistant Director of Libraries at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, also curator of the American Geographical Society Library. Marcy, welcome to the show.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Well, how did this collection come to be housed at UW-Milwaukee?
It's a long story, but I'm going to try to give you the short version. The short version being that the American Geographical Society, which is a professional organization that still exists today, built this really fantastic collection starting in 1852. And just about in the late 1960s, early 1970s, they understood that they weren't going to be able to provide a proper house for it anymore. And so they did a national search for a place to relocate the entire library. UWM put their name in the hat for the running to be the place for the library to come. And we won, I guess, yeah.
So well over a million items in this collection. Can you give us a sense of the range of what's in there?
We have approximately somewhere around 550,000 maps in the collection, somewhere in, on the verge of 625,000 images in our photo collection. And then the rest of the bulk of the collection is made up of atlases, globes. We've got about 220 globes, books, journals, and all covering a variety of topics related to geography, travel and exploration, history of cartography, history of science, history of photography, you name it, we've got it.
And this goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, spans the globe, and has lots of local material in it too, right?
Correct.
So talk about, let's start at the old end. We've got a 1452 map of the, well, I guess the known world at the time, known from Europe. Can you talk about the oldest part of the collection?
Yeah, it's so the oldest piece, you're right, is from 1452. It is a map of the world. And though we're on radio, I can describe that when you're looking at this map of the world, it doesn't really look like a map of the world as we are used to seeing maps of the world today. It was done by a cartographer named Giovanni Liardo, who was Venetian. And there are three of his maps left in the world, and we've got one of them. The other two live in libraries in Italy, in northern Italy. It's a beautiful map. It's more than 500 years old. It's in incredibly good condition. We have it framed in the collection, and anybody who wants to come into the library to take a look at it is welcome to do so.
Yeah, can you talk about, I want to talk about research in a minute, but for the public, I assume we can't go paw through the entire collection ourselves, but what kind of stuff could we see there?
You can't come in necessarily, like you said, paw through the collection, but we encourage the public to come in to use the collection. We are a public institution, so funded by the state of Wisconsin, so we are open to the public, and a lot of people come to use the collection for genealogy research. We host researchers from universities from around the world to come to the collection to do their research on whatever topic they are researching, and you can come in if you're looking for a map of a particular place. You can come and say, hey, I'd like to see a map of Warsaw, Poland, and we will pull out some maps of Warsaw, Poland, and you can take a look at them.
I understand. I hadn't heard of these. We did an interview with somebody who talked about researching old buildings as part of genealogy often, and there are these fire insurance company maps.
Yeah.
They kept really good maps, and you've got a lot of them. What kind of things do you have, and what do people do with those?
Yeah, so the Sanborn fire insurance maps are a really important piece of our collection, particularly for Milwaukee history. We have the Milwaukee Sanborn maps from the mid-1800s up through the early 1900s. And the Sanborn Fire Insurance Company is exactly what it sounds like. It was a fire insurance company. So if you are a fire insurance company, you provide fire insurance. And so what you need to know is a lot of information about the buildings in a particular place. You need to know what they're made out of, how tall they are, where there are windows, where there are doors. Are there other sorts of exits like a balcony with some steps? You need to know what's happening in that particular building. Is it a residential building? Is it some sort of manufacturing? Is it a store? And so the Sanborn company mapped towns across the United States at this level of detail and over time. So they're really important for people doing genealogy, because we can see who, in many cases, see who lived at a particular address. We can see where manufacturing was in early Milwaukee. We can see, they're fun to look at because we can see certain older parts of the city where things have been torn down and rebuilt over, and you can see that. One of our graduate students just created a web map, and you can find it on our website online, where the Sanborn maps, the old maps, are overlaid on what we call a web map, so sort of a Google map interface.
Oh, cool.
And you can search by address, and right now we only have the 1910 maps up, but you can search by address, and you can then use a slider to change the opacity of the maps, and you can see through the old map to the new web map and see what's there now and compare what used to be and what used to be in Milwaukee in 1910 and what is there now. And it's really a fantastic app. The other really important role it plays for Milwaukee history is it gives us the old street information. So in 1935, Milwaukee changed a lot of their street names, and it's always a challenge when you're doing historical research for the city, because you have to remember that that happened. And then you have to do some kind of translation, like, this place used to be this on this street, and now it's this street. And so you have to kind of remember that. And having it online as a web map is a really great way for everybody in Milwaukee to be able to figure those things out more easily.
Talking to Marcy Bidney with the UW-Milwaukee Libraries, curator of the American Geographical Society Library, this huge collection of maps, atlases, images, and more. Marcy, a lot of this is online. I was just poking around, and it could get dangerous. I almost spent too much time poking around on the digital collection. Can you talk about what's up there?
We have a range of items available in our digital collection, and we're adding to it on a daily basis. We have, I think, around 10 to 12,000 maps uploaded into our digital collections, and we don't have a particular focus as far as the map collection is concerned. We try to do a range of places around the world. If there's some hot topic going on in the world and we have maps that are related to that particular topic, we'll try to get them up. And then the bulk of our digital collections really is our photographs, and mainly because our photograph collection isn't actually print photographs. It's really the film negatives. So in order to make them usable as images, we have to digitize them so that then we can have actual, like, we can see what the image is without having to use a nitrate negative or a glass plate negative. So in the early 2000s, we had some grant funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities that allowed us to digitize around 100,000 of those images. We have about 80,000 of them online, and ranging in time frames from the late 1800s up through, I'd probably say, like about the 1970s right now. And we're also adding photos to the digital collections on a daily basis.
Now, Marcy, this is probably a really unfair question, but do you have a favorite map or series of maps in the collection?
It is an unfair question, but I get asked that question all the time. And we try not to have favorites, but it's really difficult. And it's actually really difficult to have favorites because there are so many maps in the collection, so to pick one is really difficult. But for the last couple of years, I do have one set of maps, actually, that is my favorite. And it's a set of what we call wind and current charts, and it sounds totally unsexy as far as maps are concerned, but the maps show the wind and current directions on the oceans around the world. And they're my favorite because they were made in the 1850s, and it was the first time that that information was visualized. And they were created by a cartographer, naval guy, oceanographer named Matthew Fontaine Maury. And he gathered the data by reading through thousands of naval ship logs. So just read, recorded the information, and then mapped it. And he did all of that with his brain and some paper without a computer and made some really fantastic maps. And it really contributed to improving navigation around the world. And particularly, it cut the sailing time across the Atlantic in half.
Wow.
Yeah, because the sailors were, you know, they always had a general idea of where the wind and currents were, but when you can be exact and know where you're going to pick it up and what season the wind is going to blow in a particular direction, you can hop on that current real fast, and it's going to speed up your time across the ocean. So they're really just a fascinating set of maps. And I think for me, it's really the science behind them that keeps me going back and looking at them and just being amazed.
Well, and very briefly, that sense of historical connection with the person on the other end of the map, the person who made it.
Yeah, right. And he was a pretty incredible guy. He's also considered the father of oceanography, so really started the study of the oceans around the world. So really a fantastically interesting human being.
We'll leave it there. Marcy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Marcy Bidney is the Assistant Director of Libraries at the UW-Milwaukee. She's also curator of the American Geographical Society Library, the second largest collection of maps in the country, housed at UW-Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It can be difficult to find housing for convicted sex offenders when they leave prison. States and local governments have lots of regulations limiting where they can and can't live. And residents of local communities often push back when those offenders are placed in their neighborhoods. In rare cases that do sometimes get a lot of media attention, community members have assaulted offenders placed in their community. But more often, community members band together to take political or legal action. Our next guest has studied these responses. In her new book, she looks at the placement of sexually violent criminals and the wider story of the role of communities in making criminal justice decisions like these. Monica Williams is an assistant professor of criminal justice at Weber State University and author of The Sex Offender Housing Dilemma: Community Activism, Safety, and Social Justice. Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about the sex offender housing dilemma. Talk about the challenge that we as a society face and that individual offenders face when trying to find a place to live.
So the law says that most people convicted of sex offenses can't be held indefinitely. But at the same time, no community is going to welcome someone who's been convicted of a sex crime into their neighborhoods. So the central question really is, where should they go? For community members, it means they'll have to have people convicted of sex offenders in their midst. And for people convicted of sex offenses, they'll have to find housing and try to reintegrate into those communities. And we know that having support systems are vital for reentry, but laws like residence restrictions, notification requirements, and registration requirements make it much harder for sex offenders to reintegrate. So the question becomes, how do we reconcile these opposing forces?
One key factor here is a fear, a very understandable fear in communities that, okay, if this person has been convicted of some kind of sexual offense, they're likely to do it again. What do we know about re-offense rates?
Well, we know that rates are much lower than people tend to think. Studies on the topic have found that only about 7 to 15% of sex offenders who are released commit new sex offenses. A study done in 2016 found that sex offenders reoffend with non-sexual crimes much more often than sexual crimes, and only about maybe 5.5% reoffended for rape or sexual assault. And it does differ by risk level. So those designated as high risk have a higher risk of reoffending, about 29%. But for every 5 years or so that they don't reoffend, that rate is cut in half. So overall, the rates are a lot lower than people tend to think.
Now, the heart of your book is looking at how communities of people get together and try to take action when there's a sex offender placement or a site designated as a possible place. And you found, going to different communities, a wide variety of responses. Can you talk about kind of the range of the actions you saw?
Sure. Some communities take political action. So they pressure their city council, or they pressure, in the case of the community that I studied that did this, they pressured their town council to pass a resolution against these placements and to try to keep, you know, pressure their politicians to keep sex offenders out. Other communities might take legal action. So another community I studied ended up suing the county that the town was in. And then other communities try a mixture of things and find that no one strategy really works for them. So it really depends on the community and how connected they are to political and legal institutions in their area.
When we're talking about things that communities don't want in their area, whether that might be, I don't know, a waste facility or landfill, a prison, or in this case, sexual offenders, is it a case that, okay, if we've got lots of resources, we can afford lawyers or lobbyists or lobbying time, we're going to be more successful than maybe a community with fewer resources like that?
Absolutely. And that is one of the findings in my book, is that communities that are more well-connected are better able to fight these things, but also they're less likely to have the government want to put the facilities or the people in their areas, because people who are making these decisions know that those types of communities are much more likely to resist and much more likely to be successful in resisting.
Does that end up with a situation then where you have a higher concentration of these convicted sexual offenders leaving prison going to lower income communities?
Absolutely. So one of the things I found is that by making it really hard for people, especially sex offenders, to live anywhere, state laws are essentially, and decision makers are funneling people into communities with less resources. And that means that communities, especially where people are poor and less politically connected, I heard this over and over, feel dumped on by the government. So they protest that, but their protests aren't as likely to be successful because of their lack of connections and resources.
Talking to Monica Williams, author of The Sex Offender Housing Dilemma, Community Activism, Safety, and Social Justice. And Monica, you were there, you were sitting in community meetings where people are talking about these issues. Can you talk about the kinds of arguments and concerns you heard raised in different communities?
Sure. A lot of the concerns that I heard raised are probably what you would expect. People are afraid, first of all, because they think that, as we said earlier, sex offenders are likely to reoffend. They think they're likely to be victimized by these people moving into their neighborhoods. A lot of the concerns they brought up actually were about the government, and they felt like, as I said before, they were being dumped on by the government and that they didn't have a say in the decision that was bringing people to their communities, and they wanted to be included in that decision-making process.
Are there lessons from sitting through these meetings that that maybe judges or other government officials who are making these decisions could learn to work with communities to try to make it, maybe not palatable, but acceptable to have offenders placed in their communities?
Definitely. So there's two ways to go about this. One is to change the laws, and one is to include community members in reintegration efforts, and both are really important. So in terms of laws, there are labels, like in California where I studied, they label the highest risk sex offenders as sexually violent predators, which sounds awful and stigmatizes people and makes people think that these offenders are somehow less subhuman or like animal characterization. So changing laws like that label people with these stigmatizing labels would help. Abolishing things like residence restrictions and notification laws and registration laws that studies upon studies have shown don't work. And doing that would change some of the false messages given out to the public, and then that would help to include community members in reintegration. And by include, I mean true inclusion. So not just notifying the public that the decision's been made, but actually bringing people into the process of deciding where these people are going to go.
Right. A concern I could imagine, if you don't have that label on a person, you don't have the requirement that community members be identified, I could see people in local community saying, so you want to sneak this in into our community instead of, you know, having us at least know?
Right. And I would say by getting rid of the label, I'm not necessarily saying that we need to get rid of classifications that designate different offenders based as high or low risk, but moving away from labels more toward tiers, which a lot of states have started to do, where it's based on specific factors of those offenders and deciding what risk level they're at, and then placing them into risk levels based on their specific characteristics instead of on what their offense is. So not just getting rid of the laws altogether, but actually making more empirically sound decisions about who should be in which categories and why.
You tell kind of two stories in the book. One is the one we've been talking about, this issue of sex offender placement itself, but also a wider issue of how communities take political action, whatever the issue. What kind of lessons do you take from the lens of this issue to wider issues of community political and legal activism?
Great question. The biggest lesson that I learned is that people are very passionate about their communities, and people want their communities to be the best that they can be, regardless of where they are demographically. And their resistance to a lot of these issues, sex offenders and other, you mentioned waste facilities, things like that, the resistance isn't just about not in my backyard politics. It's about people feeling powerless when they're up against the government to make their communities the best that they can be. So it's not just about sex offenders. It's about opposition to other issues as well, and looking past the initial gut reaction to just say, well, these people are just saying not in my backyard, and therefore they're being irrational, hysterical. It's about a lot more than that.
And how about policymakers maybe having an opportunity to address the perception, maybe the reality that, you know, these decisions are made before the community has any say in them?
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest issues, is that the way that it works now is a decision's been made and the public gets notified. And it truly is notification, not including communities in the decision. So instead of treating community members as legitimate actors in these decisions and people who want to make their communities safer and capitalizing on that motivation for civic engagement by really integrating them into housing decisions, decision makers and policy makers are simply making the decisions and then telling community members, we've decided that this is going to happen to you and your community. And that process is really what's driving a lot of the opposition to these issues, and that community members, they want to be included.
When we talk about political issues and criminal justice issues, a lot of the attention is laws coming out of the nation's capital or maybe at the state level. Do you think we're missing part of the story of democracy by, you know, us in the media and elsewhere not focusing on this sort of grassroots level?
Absolutely, especially because there's a tendency to just say the grassroots level is almost an obstruction to what we really want to get done. And what I'm finding is that things like opposition to some of these criminal justice policies and criminal justice decisions really are a new way of community members engaging in their communities. They want to be involved. They want to have civic engagement. It's just that the structures in place make it very hard to do so, especially, as we said, in communities that are predominantly poor and marginalized.
And on this specific issue of sex offender housing, do you, in your research, have you seen communities trying to do things differently, get the public involved up front instead of after the decision's made?
That's a great question. There are in multiple countries and in some states and communities in the U.S., there are these things called circles of support and accountability, and they've shown to be very successful. So what this is that community members, basically volunteers, will come together and create essentially a support group for sex offenders who want to reintegrate into society and work with them to help reintegration, but also hold them accountable so that when they do have issues, that they are held accountable by these community members. But it does create a good environment for reintegration, and it's been shown by multiple studies to be very successful.
We'll leave it there for now. Monica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Monica Williams, assistant professor of criminal justice at Weber State University and author of the book, The Sex Offender Housing Dilemma, Community Action, Safety, and Social Justice.